Welcome back to the Fire Break. The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire. Team Wildfire is looking to reduce firefighter fatalities to zippo. I know that sounds, you know, ambitious, but hey, nothing ventured, nothing gained, and to reduce property losses as well. So all this in the wildfire realm, and I believe that with the right techniques, tactics, and technology, we could do it. You know, we put one on the moon. Okay, there were some losses along the way there, but we've learned a lot since then. Anyway, enough about me and my old stuff. I've got the amazing Chad Acosta with us here. Now, what's amazing about Chad is that if you had to hire staffing for a fire department, but you only had the budget to hire one person, Chad could do it, because Chad's been an engineer. He's been the dispatcher. He's been the battalion chief, the fire captain, chief cook and bottle washer. And now he's the assistant fire chief for the Petaluma Fire Department. So yeah. Across the board, there's not a job in the fire service that Chad hasn't held and done well, or at least well enough to get promoted to the next thing. Now, I know in reality, sometimes we promote people just to get them out of our hair. But you know, in Chad's case, that is not the truth. And neither in mine, because I don't have any hair to get promoted out of. Chad, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great, Steve. Thanks for having me. I appreciate everything you're doing.
Oh, likewise. You know, I say this like with all in all sincerity, like you're one of the most respected guys in fire service. And because people know you worked your way through every position, you know exactly what everyone's going through. When you ask someone to do a job, you've done that job yourself. So that's, I think, one of the really great things people look for in leadership, is an understanding of what you're actually asking of people. So what's the secret to your brilliant career?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the kind words. I soaked that in for a minute.
Okay. You know,
in this position, or with everything, all the different, as I said before, for our discussion, you know, all the different lanes that I drive down, I commonly find myself in the fast lane, and then in the next minute, three lanes over, and moving back and forth. And ultimately it all ties into just what you have. You know, what I always say is what you have behind the badge. You know, I'm not necessarily a rank driven person. I think everything just comes from who you are as a person and who you are behind that badge. And
Yep. Your
work ethic, your heart, your how much you care, not only about the people that you work with, the people you surround yourself with, but also how much you care about the job and the passion to provide a service to the people, and always seeking other additional opportunities to be better at that, not only personally, but with the services that we provide. So for me, it's a kind of an interesting story. You know, just grew up in a West Sonoma County on a ranch, two parents that were hardworking, no education beyond high school. And just the work ethic was instilled at a young age, and also instilled into me as I moved into the fire service in Cal Fire. And that's the root of I would say my success, is just that unwavering dedication to the job and to the people and to the mission. That's the core of it. Some of it's luck. I've had some really amazing opportunities to gain experience on federal incident management teams and Cal Fire incident management teams. I've worked for seven different agencies at a state level, a district level, a city level, just to kind of get those perspectives and to understand, you know, do you understand the do's and don'ts, and to make mistakes and learn from them, and people that mentored me and trusted me, you know, to let me get back on my feet and to move forward. So, but to, just to close it off, really, it just comes back to that, the core of who you are as a person, and that's how you can be successful in this job.
So when you hire, you're looking at the person, not at the resume.
Yeah, I mean, I've written articles about that. You know, I've done podcasts about that. I think what's really turned our organization around, and not that it was, you know, in a really bad place or anything, but when we're talking specifically about hiring and promoting, Yeah, that's what I try to instill in the people that either reach out to me for mentorship or the people in the organization or surrounding organizations is there's a balance between the resume and the person. And both of them are super important, especially as you get higher ranking into higher level positions, whether it's private or public service. But ultimately, yeah, what are you really looking for? You're looking for that person that truly cares and truly does want to do a good job. And then we as an organization or supervisors, need to find the strengths and weaknesses of our employees, prop them up in the areas that there's weaknesses. And once we do that, and once you get that culture instilled in your organization where it's really a bottom up and you're really trying to build it from the bottom, it's amazing what you can accomplish. So yeah, that's kind of, my thought process.
So I'm guessing that for you to take that mentorship role in building up the qualifications of the people who, you hope will one day replace you, you probably had some good examples along the way, right? Did you have some people who really took you under their wing and said, Chad, here's how to be really good at this, and right?
I mean, ultimately, it's kind of interesting. I feel super blessed to be able to be in the fire service during the stretch of 25 years that I have. Because when I came in, even 25 years ago, at least what I was surrounded around was slightly different than what it is today. The expectations of the fire service, we call it the fire service, really, that's kind of a poor name for the fire department, really, because fire is just a small portion of what we do. There's just so many things that we provide and so many new expectations and the people that we serve. So fire is just a portion of that. But growing up in this job, it was really about trying to find those people that were successful. And it's sort of changed. Early on, it was more about who trying to kind of mold myself and learn from those people that were successful on the fire ground or in the emergency scene. Because I was more, firefighter hands-on, not really thinking high level 30,000 foot view. So that's what I attracted to, which was very successful for me because it helped build that work ethic and that desire and that devotion to the organization and really the pride in this job and the pride in the patch that you wear. As I started getting older and started realizing that I wanted to be a leader, I wanted to be an executive leader, I wanted to fly a little bit higher than where I was, I sort of transitioned into looking at those people like, Chief Dan Muncy of San Bernardino County, who out there are successful at a younger age, because I was young into my promotional aspirations, who is successful and how are they successful? Reggie Freeman, the past Oakland fire chief, those kind of people are who I try to model myself by. And I've spent time, talking to them, emailing them, having these kind of conversations to really try to mold who I am because, I'm never going to be them. But there's traits that got them to where they got. To be the fire chief of those organizations, you did something right, and to be
100%.
successful in that position. So it's sort of changed. I think it has changed on who I try to mold myself after and evaluate and really dive into. But that's probably normal as you
Yeah.
transition up the ladder.
Can I see that bracelet? What would Reggie do? Yeah.
He's great, and he's successful because not only because of his intelligence, but I truly believe it's how much he cares about the job and the people that he's around in the community he works for, which is my lead into this. And if you can do that, people give you benefits of the doubt. People will support you in your weaknesses and your areas that maybe you struggle. I mean, I'm not a super big EMS person, but I'm technically in charge of EMS in the organization. And so I get to surround myself by some people that are subject matter experts in that. That way I can, ultimately the organization can be successful. But
Isn't that fun
yes.
to be surrounded by people who are really brilliant at things that you're interested in, but not an expert in? And You get to
Yes.
learn from them and be around them every day. Like I think that's really inspirational. And that's really, that's why I started this podcast, because I'm
Yeah.
fascinated by, guys like you and other people in the business, and just to have the opportunity to learn and to and then to share, what I learned with other people, because
Yeah.
people should know about guys like you. Because you're somebody else, you're somebody's Reggie, right? You're maybe a lot of people's Reggie, and
So.
when we I guess as you get older and you think about time and the fact that we all have an expiration date, and we've accumulated hopefully a little bit of wisdom along the way, then the big push in life becomes how fastly how quickly fastly how quickly can I disseminate everything I've learned so it becomes useful to somebody in the next generation. And I
Yeah, for sure. I
love
mean,
seeing you do that.
there's a couple. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. What did you say?
I was just going to say, ultimately, there's kind of this misconception to leadership in the fire service, and leadership's probably the wrong word, but let's say the chief, let's throw the chief word out there. And chief word can be a lot of different ranks, not necessarily the fire chief, but there's this sense of, when you promote and you move into higher positions, that you have to know everything. And that's a really, that's a failure of leadership and a failure of mentorship, is you don't have to know everything. You better be good at listening, and you better be good at using the strengths and weaknesses of the employees that you're surrounded by, the people you're surrounded by, and identifying those. And self-reflection is so important in that,
Yeah,
because
you don't have to know everything. You just have to know, you have to know what needs to be known, and you have to figure out who knows it and get them to solve that problem with you. And
I get it.
that's where you multiply it. So tell me, what's going on in fire now, particularly in the wildfire space? It probably wouldn't be a reach to say it seems worse than it's ever seemed, in recent history. It's certainly the case that it's on everyone's mind. Certainly I'm watching what's going on in Texas today as they're, my brother lives in Texas, and I called him yesterday and I said, Andy, it looks like this fire has reached, the 300,000 acre point. It's now at 500. And he said, come on, Steve, this is Texas. People have driveways bigger than that. But, it's now already Texas's second biggest fire. And then it looks like it's the time for record breaking in wildfire's career. So this is, I'm guessing, something of big concern to you, to your agency, to the people you serve. What do you see happening, and what do you think are the directions that we need to be tackling this from?
Yeah, no, great question. It's interesting, having this discussion today in 2024 versus having this discussion, which I had way too many times, in the 2017, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, that kind of 5 to 7 year stretch that we had. I'm coming from California in the Sonoma County area, north of San Francisco, and you look at a wildfire, anybody that paid any attention to wildfires in that 16 through kind of 20 fire season knows how devastated we were. I've been evacuated multiple times, almost lost my own home, have been a part of the leadership of fires, 1 million plus acres, watched communities burn down. Fortunately, a lot of loss, not only lives, but property, and ultimately forest, and just some of the beautiful landscape that we had is now, sticks. So it's been rough. It's been rough in California. I've traveled north into Oregon to fires. I've been to Washington, been to New Mexico. Was part of the incident management team that went to Hawaii last year and spent a month there, helping them out. Ultimately, it's the circling back to why I think it's kind of an interesting conversation is it's we've had some wetter winters here in California the last few years. The summers have been less windy than we experienced in the summers that we had in those prior 5 to 7 years. And I think some of it is cycles of just how the earth turns. And it's interesting to watch how different regions, every other summer, every summer, however you want to look at it, different regions go through these record-breaking wildfires. And yes, it's obvious that, we are breaking more records. It's just not necessarily always just in California. It's now we're seeing it, in Hawaii, we're seeing it in other countries, just devastating wildfires. And for us in California, it's really interesting is I think, California has the best or the strongest fire service, in the world. We have an unbelievable team of CAL FIRE, staff and people, just amazing high-level people. We have an amazing air fleet that is growing by the day, for that aerial attack, which is super important for a lot of wildland situations. We have engines, travel to other states and go to some of these fires, and you're like, where's everybody at? A few thousand people on a fire here is no big deal, and you might have, 400 or 500 on the same size fire in another state. So we have all these resources. We've done an unbelievable job at increasing our technology, and trying to really improve our abilities to battle these things. But what's really cool to see in the fire service is a transition from just worrying about the response to the to also the focus on the prevention side of things. And CAL FIRE, the federal government, the Forest Service is, in my opinion, is changing or adjusting their thought process. They're putting a lot more emphasis on the prevention side of things, hardening homes, hardening communities, fire breaks, those kind of things. PG&E, which is the Northern California, provider for power, there's a different one in SoCal, but point being is there's a lot of emphasis from that company to prevent the fires, versus responding. So the fire service in this interesting transition where I think it's now where response was for the first 20 years of my career was kind of higher than the prevention side. We've really recognized, and not necessarily recognized, but really emphasized the need for the prevention to be as good or better, and to prevent these things from happening. Because the reality is that we can come up with a lot of things to help us fight wildfire and save homes and save lives. We can do that, and we are. But in certain scenarios, when you're dealing with 70, 80, 90 mile an hour winds, you're dealing with high temperatures, low humidities, you're dealing with prolonged drought in communities or in forests, it's bigger than us. It is bigger than us, and there are situations where we just have to see, honestly, there's done this many times, get the heck out of the way, and just save your life. So let's prevent the fire from occurring. And that's kind of where I think the fire services today is really trying to level those out and put a lot of emphasis into not only response, but also prevention.
Yeah, it's right. Your sense of perspective is really important there, and people recognize that fires are really the only natural disaster over which we can have any influence. We haven't figured out how to prevent hurricanes yet, or we haven't figured out how to prevent earthquakes, right? So most of the emergency community is centered around response,
Yes.
right? Because if something happens and we react to it. And then now you must find yourself pinched between the place of, hey, there's something we could do about this, and we should, and it reduces losses when we do that, and the politics of it, which are like, no one is going to reelect you to buy more rakes, right? They're going to reward you for buying more fire trucks and hiring more response personnel. And that's, it's a little short-sighted, but that's America, right? We, no money for prevention, endless money for response. And because you've been in this for 25 years, you are now in a position where you take the long view versus like elected officials who take, at best the 4-year view, or if they're really lucky, the 8-year view. And that's not a substantial perspective from which to address the problem. So it's career guys like you who've seen the evolution of this and appreciate the value of the prevention and mitigation efforts, that are really gonna lead change. And you've got to figure out, how am I going to influence the politicians and the people who hold the purse strings to get them to spend money on this thing that's not so sexy, you know, that just not so that doesn't look heroic, right?
Yeah, that's a challenge for sure.
Right. The surgeon who cures your, you know, who cuts out your cancer, like they're the hero. The dietitian who could have prevented it in the first place, like no credit, no interest.
Very good analogy.
So do you have strategies that you're using on how to make mitigation more popular?
Yeah, it's not for me, it's not as a challenging, like everything you said is true. But I also think that the leadership at government, government levels or city levels also under or have a better understanding that we can't continue, like, of course,
We
we don't
could.
know everything. So it could happen.
Yeah.
But these devastating wildfires that when we're talking specifically about wildfire, when you burn down communities, and you have the what I think is the greatest fire department in the world, and by fire department, I'm including CAL FIRE and all the mutual aid partners and all the cities and districts and all the fire departments that are out there like mine. Like I'm on a CAL FIRE incident management team, but I work for the city of Petaluma. The California Fire Service is amazing. Has more planes and more helicopters and more people to throw at it than any other state and any other country. But we're burning 1 million acres and we're burning communities down. Like, so it's because of that disaster that we went through, those disasters that we're going through, I'm finding it easier to sell the prevention side. It's really in the fire service today is community called community risk reduction. And essentially we're changing that instead of prevention, it's risk reduction. And it's changing the approach to say, hey, here's the deal. Here's some things that we can do that are quantifiable and to help reduce that risk. Now, we may not be able to eliminate it and we may not be able to stop it from occurring, but what can we do to risk that reduce that risk? And so it's amazing. When you sit in front of the council or you sit in front of your leadership in your city and you say, here's a structured report that we have of the risk in our community, and here's some things that we can do to reduce that risk, and you really show some quantifiable data, and you can be able to show where those actions and mitigations have been successful in other areas. Now, I'm going to relate this to something else here in a second, but now, your cell, it sells itself. And
Yeah.
that's what the fire service has finally been, in my opinion, in my career, has been able to do because now we're implementing some of these strategies. We're implementing some of these tactics in the prevention side or the risk reduction side that are being able to show successes. You have this community out in the forest area and there's a fire and you burn a couple buildings down, and I won't talk about fires or communities, but I can give some examples where communities were saved. And so we got to take those wins, like anything
Yes.
else. You take those wins and you pull that data and that information. What did they do? How did they attack it? And you just relate that to to my community or the community I work in or live in, and you say, look, this is what we can do in our community to have these similar results. That is working, and it's really cool for me. I'm really excited about the next generation of the fire service in the sense of the community risk reduction part of it. And what goes with that too is the community outreach and just the information and the knowledge that the people and the citizens have, being able to communicate with them early and have them well prepared, because the reality is the fire service can't protect every single person. It's it'd
Right.
be
No
a
more than the police can prevent every robbery, right?
We just don't have enough fire, and people are like, why isn't there a fire engineer? It's like, well, there's 1,000 fire engines and there's 5,000 houses, so they can't be at every one. But if we get that community outreach, if we do that, take that time to really educate our community on what they can do on their own, not only during the emergency but pre-emergency, i.e., vegetation management and things like that, now we're a big train rolling down the track, and now we're having success because we're going to have to do this together. This is not, this is not something that the fire service can tackle on its own. It needs the help of every citizen out there doing what they can to help us. And I could share information about, there's been fires that I've been on where we've been successful. There's been fires that we haven't. And generally, a lot of times, it's that pre-work. It's the pre-work that helps, and that early notification and communication to the public to get them out of the way or get them to safety.
And the corollaries are huge, right? Just like we saw people clamoring, why aren't there enough ventilators in the hospital? And you won't even wear your mask. So, right, like there's stuff that you could do to reduce the demand for the big, heavy equipment response. Like if you would just, rake the leaves out of your gutter and put the amber guards up on your vents, you could reduce the need for the fire trucks. And, we both know one fire truck at a structure fire is not going to cut it, right? We're looking at typically five apparatus to make a difference.
Very true.
It's very interesting. And maybe in the future we'll see, a politician's posing in front of a pile of leaves instead of the new, C-130 or the new Firehawk that they just bought. But there's still not this perception that prevention, is going to get the attention that it needs. But, as you start to prove that out, I'm curious, so you're starting to amass data showing that prevention, risk reduction works, right? It saves firefighters' lives. It saves resources. It cuts down on the number of, apparatus and chemicals they have to distribute, the whole thing. So once we know that something works, does it then become negligent not to do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think if you identify a problem in your, so risk reduction, the first part of it is what are the risks? You got to have a well done evaluation of your risk. And we do that in our community. We're trying to get a better understanding of here's a good example. In the fire service, we do things like smoke detector programs, right? We go out into what we think are areas of need, and we install smoke detectors, let's say in a elderly trailer park, or something like that. We're like, hey, we go door to door. We ask them that they have smoke detectors. If they don't, we install. Those are great programs.
Yeah.
But the falsity of those programs is when we think we know where the need is. And so there's new tools out there to educate and poll our community, all of our community, about where that risk is and is it a risk or not, or is it an issue that we need to address. When we receive that data back, commonly what happens is you kind of have a wow moment or a oh moment where you're like, I didn't think that community had that risk. I just perceived it not to because of my experiences. And what the fire service is, we're really getting better at really evaluating our community and what are those risks. And to your question, if we're going to commit to those kind of evaluations where we're really looking at the risks, whether it be wildfire or whether it be fall prevention or whether it be flooding or whatever the risks are to your community. Yeah, I mean, I would be very concerned about not addressing them or not doing something to mitigate or at least make efforts towards mitigating. And that to me is like, well, if you're not doing that, which I make an assumption that most agencies and most fire departments, at least in California and in the United States, are doing some of that. Some are leaps and bounds in front of others. That might be cost reason, there might be financial reasons, it might be staffing, it may mean that there's different risks in every community, and some communities don't have a high level of risk in certain things. That being said, I would never jump into that water if I knew that we weren't going to be able to do anything about it. Like, you got to identify the risk and you got to do something about it. And I say this to everybody, people talk about, hey, in our department, we have a mission and a goal to increase, DEIB and those kind of things and diversify our organization, which doesn't always necessarily mean male, female or color, but just more diversity. Right. Well, people say, Chad, why do you only have you know, seven females in your organization. You should have more. Well, here's the deal. I can say, hey, well, that's a priority for us. It's a priority for Chet. But if I don't follow up with what I'm doing to improve it, then it's garbage. And so to your point, if we're going to say that community risk reduction is really important in our organizations and we're going to stand up in front of our constituents and say that they're important to us, then I think it is negligent to identify a risk and not do anything about it. Now, where to point blame at that, I don't think that's fair, but it would be a problem in my mind.
Well, it seems like, you know, some form of financial responsibility or accountability or financial risk for not doing something seems to be, you know, a motivator, right? If I go faster than 55 miles an hour on this road, I know I'm going to get a big ticket. So, you know, I don't do it. Right. So if city managers felt like, well, there's all these risk reduction strategies that we could implement, and we chose not to do them because we wanted to, you know, get new furniture in the movie lounge.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then you are putting yourselves at risk, you know, for legal exposure there.
Agreed.
So sometimes you just, you know, sometimes you have to, like, you have to stick more than carrot to get people to do what you want. Hopefully you could do both, you know.
Yeah. But I could just speak for my situation.
Yeah.
Honestly, the conversations and the needs and the, that whole process, I never want to say like it takes tragedies to change things, but sometimes it does.
Well, it does, right? No tragedy should go unwasted.
Right. And I mean, we're pretty successful at these kind of conversations nowadays. And the city manager in this city is 100% on board on, you know, she cares a lot about the community.
Yeah.
And so does the council members. And so when we go to them with a chipper program or some kind of program that we feel is going to help reduce risks in the community, we're getting support and a ton of support. Now, some of these things, the challenging part is we can want and provide as much as we want, but we, like I spoke of earlier, it really, really requires the community to be on board with it and to help you through that, because sometimes we're talking about mitigations on people's property. You know, it's not necessarily city owned property. It could be your house and your lot that you own. So it takes a partnership.
Let me ask you about the chipper program. Just as a, you know, as a scientist, I think if I want to catch something on fire, I should increase its surface ratio to mass and volume. Mm-hmm. Right. So if I take a tree, it's hard to catch it. If I cut it into logs, it's easier to catch it. And if I mulch it, it's even easier to catch it.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about how does mulching things, what happens to that mulch that would prevent it from becoming just ember catching beds?
Yeah, no, good question. So we don't, in our program here, it's transported off site. So it's not put back onto the soil.
Got it.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately, what are we talking about? You know, we're talking about creating space between residences and flammable vegetation.
Sure.
We're talking about reducing the amount of fuel load that's on your property. We're talking about reducing fuel load along exit routes.
Yeah.
So that when you know, I can show videos.
Yeah.
Be in wildfires where my wife wouldn't want to watch the video. You know, it's hairy and responders and people die, unfortunately, trying to escape wildfire because of the large trees and large vegetation that's along the roadway creates a smoke and fire that they're driving through.
Right. So we need that evacuation route hardening. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And we're also talking about, you know, lifting the ladder fuels or the fuels that carry. So if there is bark or chips or something on the ground, you're talking about a low level, low intensity fire, which isn't a big deal if you have the correct space away from your house.
Right.
But where it becomes a big deal is when you have the bushes and the trees that aren't pruned or the trees that aren't, you know, the vegetation's not reduced, you know, up to 10 feet. And now that low-level fire, that low-level vegetation fire that you had is now climbed into the trees or the bushes or the vegetation, which becomes this fireball that gets carried, you know, embers and pushed by wind. So I mean, the chips on the ground for me are much less work, you know, not as a big of a deal as it would be to have, you know, vegetation and bushes and brush around your house.
What's your thought on that 30-foot radiant heat risk?
Yeah.
They want to keep those fuels that can generate a lot of heat at least 30 feet from your house, or else just through radiant heat, you're going to burst into flames.
Yeah, it's, you know, really we have to, when we're talking about hardening your home, there's so many factors that go into it. It is difficult to say there's a black and white line.
Yeah, right.
But ultimately, like, where is your house placed? How is it built? Is it on a hill, you know, where that radiant heat and that transfer of heat is easier? All those are factors. But the reality is that the fire service really isn't like saying, hey, cut down all the trees. Like my parents, you know, bless them, my family, they have homes in the rural areas and we have these discussions all the time. And the big fear when this stuff was coming out, insurance companies are denying them insurance and all these things, is like, we're going to have to cut down all of our trees. And it's like, no, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that what kind of vegetation is it? How far away is it from the house? And what can you do with that vegetation to make it, to harden it, to reduce the risk? It's not about, like, it's never the goal that it's just, that you're never going to burn something. Like, well, I shouldn't say this that way, but I mean, like, it's not realistic to say that we're never going to burn something down, or that something's never going to catch on fire. I mean, in that space, build your home in the middle of the desert where there's no vegetation. And yeah, you're not going to burn it down by a vegetation fire. But we also have to realize is that there's a beauty and a reason why people live outside the cities. And I grew up with that, and I'm very blessed to have that experience. It's an amazing place. I still go to my parents' house on a regular basis. But I would never tell them that, hey, you know, you got to mow every tree down anywhere near your house. But what we did do is we spent months reducing the vegetation, thinning the trees, taking out those high hazard trees, ensuring that that vegetation that is near the house is maybe fire resistant. You know, we hardened the home and hardened the area around it to reduce the risk of wildfire, but try to preserve the beauty of truly living in, you know, California and some of the most beautiful places.
Yeah,
in the world.
Right. That's why they do it. What are your thoughts on rather than simple fuel reduction or vegetation reduction, chemical treatment with safe long-term exterior approved chemo barriers, essentially, where you could drive down an evacuation route, especially if it's a single point of egress to a community, and lay out a long-term retardant, our idea is like use jet engines to distribute it into the foliage and really penetrate back so that the trees on both sides of the roads aren't burning and falling and trapping people in their cars and burning them up. And your wife probably shouldn't see that video. Yeah. I think
there's a few that I haven't shared with her for sure.
Yeah.
I know. I watched what you have going on. You know, I've been involved with pre-treatment of roads. I've been involved with pre-treatment of homes. I do think the technology that's coming out there with how it, you know, it when I started, you know, when I was first introduced to, let's say, like a pre-application type gel that you would put on a home. Well, the challenge was if you would apply this and it was only good for so long, and then you had to reapply water to it to reactivate it. There was some limitations to how well that would work. And there's also, you know, a lot of these things have a cost to them, which, you know, when new technologies are out there, they can be challenging for certain places to afford.
Sure.
But I think these are the conversations that are important and the things that are going on, because the reality is that what we've done isn't necessarily working. I mean, I can drive through a lot of communities near me and where I live that's got a lot of new homes because it didn't work. You know, the bulldozer I can't tell you how many times, we put amazing fire line in. We put all this effort and time and into cutting trees down, making breaks, and using all this heavy equipment. And then the fire picks up to a 70 mile an hour wind, and it's got, like you said, a mile past you, the fire is already.
Right. Unless you can stop the ember cast from going 40 miles, like what's, you know, if I hear mineral soil again, like, you know, unless you're mining for minerals, you know, making that break is not stopping the types of fires that we're seeing today, as far as I can tell. You tell me if I'm wrong on that.
Well, I think my perspective and what I've seen is that it does work, and it is a good tactic. It depends on the situation and depends on the scenario. And most recently in the last, 10 years, when you're dealing with heavy drought conditions and high wind, it's much less effective. But this is the challenge that I've faced myself with many times out there is, well, what do I do? What's my percentage of success? There's a mentor of mine. He's since retired. In my opinion, a wildfire just he's just amazing. Just a lot of experience. I won't use his
Who's
name.
that?
He's a pretty amazing person, and I listen to everything he says. And every time I would go to him with a plan or an idea on the division or the branch or the section of the fire that I had, he would always ask me, "What do you think your percentage of success is?" And it's an educated guess, right?
Yeah.
But what he was trying to get across is like we have tactics and strategies that we use in the fire service. But if your percentage is low, and I'll speak to this a little bit more, if your percentage is low, you have to ask yourself, should we be doing that? And sh or should we step to something else that maybe have a higher percentage, which may be the next ridge or maybe the next road or something else or a different tactic, right? But what's really challenging out there is even if you in your mind are like, hey, this is a low percentage of success for this, there's this other person on the other shoulder that's telling you, well, you got to do something, Chad. You got to
Right.
try something. And although it may not work, I'm going to feel better about this if we at least try it than if we don't do anything. And so what you're talking about, Steven, well, the way I want to look at this or the way this works in my brain is increasing those probabilities of success
Yep.
and to bring it from a 10% to a 25 or a 25 to a
Sure.
50. That's what we're trying to accomplish here. And increasing your probability of success is the totality of everything that we're doing, not only in the response and the tools and the things that you're talking about, but also that prevention and the work
Yeah.
that we're doing prior. And that's really what it ties to. And I think all those things, all the new technologies, pre-treating vegetation, whether it's removing the vegetation with different tools, those are increasing the probabilities of success. We're not maybe not be 100%, but let's try to get it higher than what we've had it in the past.
Absolutely. You know, I saw this morning we had to shut down the nuclear arms manufacturing plant, you know, in Texas, because I'm going to venture out and say insufficient mitigation was done around it. You know,
Possible.
if right, if it had to be shut down, and I would think that the military would have a pretty strong interest in keeping fire off of its bases and its production line facilities, simply as a matter of national defense. And I really hope that they do make that a priority. Not simply because it improves our you know, our defense and offensive capabilities, but because if we see the military take an interest in wildfire suppression and mitigation and risk reduction technologies, those technologies will then down the road be available to you. And you don't have the budget to develop the tools that you need the way the military does. So I think to the degree that we can frame this as a homeland security issue, we're more likely to see funding develop that will give us, you know, next generation, you know, Star Wars fires, you know, right? If the DoD thought this was a problem, you'd see satellites that could suppress fire from space, not just detect them, right? You'd see all types of things happening that would then, I believe, filter over to the civilian fire market.
I agree.
So I'd love to see, you know, more participation from those agencies in this.
Yeah.
Right. I got GPS on my phone, you know, not because Apple wants me to have GPS. You know, I've got it because the military needed to get around the desert and Desert Storm, and there's no roads there. So this trickle over from miltech to civilian tech, I think is going to hold a lot of promise.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about what areas you think, you know, technology, you know, future tech could help you. And
Yeah.
I'm personally a fan of the idea that AI could be very useful in the tactics for any given fire, right? You know what fires you've seen, and you've known what worked, and probably learned a lot about what didn't work as well. But you haven't seen all the fires, you haven't trained on every fire, and it's hard to keep in your mind, you know, what the suppression capabilities are of each apparatus that you can bring to the fire to know the perfect chess match strategy
Yeah.
for putting out. Do you think that AI has a role in that in the future?
Well, I think it already is playing a role. You know, for just two simple examples, are AI being combined with cameras, you know, and being able to detect early detection of smoke, and that's been, I mean, in California, you know, Alert Wildfire West, and these cameras that are, I forget how many are up now, but they're everywhere. When you go on the website, they're starting to spread into other states. Now I get it. That's a little bit more on the response side. That's not the prevention side, but just getting that early detection on the fire and being able to notify us immediately in the camera to be able to see, you know, recognize the smoke and alert us very early on. So we're not finding out when it's 50 acres, we're finding out
Right.
it's a 10th of an acre. So that's an area of AI. The other area is fire modeling. And that is, you know, Technosylva and those companies have done just an amazing job at helping us model. Hey, in these scenarios, there's some deficiencies in it. You know, the specific one is where you put that point of ignition on the map. The conditions are pretty accurate typically, right? We have a lot of weather
Yeah.
stations everywhere, so we can kind of simulize, hey, wind direction, temperature, fuel, live fuel moisture, you know, dead fuel moistures, those kind of things. But where you put that match essentially on the map can affect the model. Is the match being put at the top of the ridge, being at the bottom of the ridge, or the bottom below the community instead of above the community? And sometimes, you know, that's probably the most difficult part of that modeling, is just putting that match in the right place. But AI has helped tremendously in 2020, 2018. Anyways, the years are running together and the fires run together. But there's a model that was produced that said the fire up near my home was going to potentially burn all the way to the ocean. Now, when I heard that and I saw the model, my mind said, there's no way. There's no way that's going to happen. Well, it didn't, thank God. But my point being is that modeling help us determine evacuation areas and
Right.
evacuation plans, and how, where is the fire, where do we predict that fire to be? I do think AI is very helpful in the modeling side of things by taking that data of all the different fires and all the different scenarios and being able to say, okay, it's not just a couple 30-year Cal Fire veterans. You know, we have to listen to them, because sometimes, you know, we forget we have eyes and a brain and we rely so much on the computer. We don't
Yeah.
want to do that. We want to use both. And there's a practical side of this, but point being is, I absolutely do. I think the technology and the fire service, the one area that is really concerning to me and something that I don't feel has had enough, I don't feel it's been addressed to a point for everyone that's a realistic scenario because of funding, is the cellular connection or that satellite connection. The ability, like fires aren't always happening in the downtown San Francisco where there's 5G, five bars, and upload and download speeds that can fly PDFs to everybody and read them. The reality is fires are occurring in and usually poor communication areas. And that's been the biggest challenge for me is, listen, there's some branches I've had that are ridiculously large, especially on a 1 million-acre fire. You're placed in response where I had two divisions one time where it took me 8 hours to drive each of them. So it's a 2-day event to drive the landscape that I'm responsible for. There's hundreds of apparatus and people that are assigned to me that I'm responsible for. Well, how am I really going to be able to manage that when I'm guessing a lot of times about where's the fire at? Where are they at? Are they in a safe position? Is the tactics and strategies that they're employing are deploying aligned with the strategies that I'm thinking that we're implementing? Those are very difficult situations. And really where that becomes successful is technology. It's technology and it's also the communication link between everyone and the
Right.
ability when I drive outside of a cellular tower, or if I don't have satellite connection, or if I don't have the funding in my agency to purchase Starlink or all these great things that are out there that aren't cheap, then I probably don't have those. And you're probably going to see me in a vehicle that has a cell phone that don't work, a tablet that only I can view what's hard on the machine, and a large map or a couple maps that has a bunch of drawings on them and a piece of paper. Well, not going to say
No,
that
I get it.
I'm not going to
I
say that
get
doesn't work, but I can share with you that the probability of success is so
is
substantially less.
dropping. You're right. So what I'm wondering about for AI, so the way it's being used right now, for in differentiation of detections and in modeling of, where's the fire heading, those basically are just continuing to add data to your plate, but you're still responsible for parsing that data and coming up with a suppression plan. And as you said, if you have 200 plus, apparatus and thousands of people out there, I think that AI could be useful to you, not just in overloading you with more information about the fire, but in helping you make decisions about how to deploy those resources optimally. Because you can think about, three, four, five ways you might use these assets, and an AI system could model out, here's 50,000 ways that this could play out, and I've moved the apparatus and the people around in all different orders and gamed out what would happen, and here's the scenario, here's the deployment strategy that, based on everything you've taught me, taught the AI, this strategy is going to be the most successful one for you. Now, we don't want AI to make the decision, but to create the option of the decision for you and say, here's what I think your highest probabilities of success are. Will you sign off on these things? And you click yes, and then it sends out the orders to the troops, or it sends out the orders to the autonomous equipment and said, right, because I think we could reduce, firefighter fatalities if we were to, don't send a man to do a robot's job. Right. And there's a lot of places where we can't fight fire simply because it's not a safe place to put a person, not because it's not the best place to fight the fire from. We just don't want to compromise a crew. So, do you see a scenario where we have firefighting bots, giant machines that go knock fires down or pop, take the trees,
Certain there's a time and a place for that, absolutely. I want to speak, real quickly about the tactics-driven AI, and strategy-driven AI, and that would be, so I'm going to give you a couple of scenarios. One of the challenging parts that we have is, and this and there's there could be there's going to be or there has been or there will be speakers that speak to you or people that speak on these topics that are much more knowledgeable than I am, but I'm going to share with you some of the challenges that I have in the real world. Let's say you get show up to a fire in a community that you don't know, which is common. Yeah, you're going into an area that I haven't studied, that I don't know well, and you're asked to be responsible for a section of the fire. And you're, let's say within that section of the fire is a community, and you know your goal is to save life, property, and the environment, right? That's what your goal is. You're given all these tools. So I'm given bulldozers, I'm given hand crews, I'm given fire engines, all different types. I'm given aircraft. I'm given some intel about the area, the fire modeling. You know, there's a lot of information that we're taking in. And like to your point, how do I deploy those resources to increase my probability of success as high as possible? Not only how, but where. And that's our job, and that's 100% on us to figure that out and to do something. So what would be really amazing, I love the concept. You know, I have some concerns about the data in the program and how valid is it, and how do you get, you know, that's for people that are much smarter than me. But my point being is I have this scenario where, and this is real, it's a real scenario, where I'm given, I pull up, I ask some questions, I get some information. It's a fast-growing incident. It's early on in the incident, and it's like, hey, just go out there and come back and bring us some intel and give us an idea of what you think we should do with the left flank of this fire. I get up, I drive around for a couple hours, I look at this community, I look at the situation, I come back and I say, hey, I think we can save this community, but I need bulldozers and I need to put a line here to here. And they're like, okay, we got 10 bulldozers sitting over there in staging. This is literally how this went. I'm like, well, give them to me. And so, okay, take them. You know, jot down all their numbers. And we're in a line of 10 dozers and me and a pickup. And we drive to point A and we start putting in line. And to this day, from the fire chief of that community, is like, you know, the people in the community think we were heroes for doing that. But what the piece that you're missing here and the piece that you're talking about is how many hours did it take for us to divulge or to come up with this plan? How lucky were we that there happened to be 10 bulldozers sitting there? And how lucky were we truly that the plan worked? Because ultimately this was just a, I think this is going to work, but my probability of success at the time was kind of 50-50. My point being is I do see a future of just intel, that ability. It's kind of like baseball when you talk about analytics. You know, like if we're just analytics driven and we don't have that gut and that eyes and that person that's been doing it, I don't think it works. But if you put analytics in the decision making of the tactics and strategies that we're employing, it's going to increase our ability of success and increase our ability to pick the right one at the right place at the right time with the right tools. And that I 100% agree with you, Steve. That is going to take AI, and it's going to take, you know, really smart people in a computer-driven environment to say, okay, here's your inputs, here's your match, here's your fire, here's the conditions. Our recommendation essentially is that this is what you do. And we as future fire, you know, maybe not my time, but the next generation of firefighters, I truly believe are going to have those more of those tools at their hand to make better decisions about when and where and why. So I'm all in on that. I would love, gosh, imagine going, can I go to a fire and have all this data and information given to me to help me make decisions? And oh, by the way, I have a connection and the ability to communicate with up and down the chain of command. You know, in those situations, like I've been out in the middle of nowhere where I can't talk to anybody. I can't, not on a phone, not on a radio. I have no idea where I am other than a map, you know, a paper map. And I'm really trying to put together a plan to potentially save or stop a fire. And sometimes it's worked and sometimes it hasn't, but that's the reality of the leadership out there today and our world.
No, it's an exciting time in
It
that, right, in that the magnitude of the problem is growing, but the magnitude of the people looking at the problem and coming up with solutions is also growing.
Agreed.
So, yeah, The most unfortunate thing is that we won't be around in 100 years to see, you know, Skynet detect and put these fires out, and everyone stays home and gets home to their families.
I agree.
Yes. But, you know.
That's okay. I mean, there's
that,
that,
yeah.
I tell everybody with this, our department here in Petaluma, you know, we're going through an amazing, you know, next 10 years. I do think that there's some initiatives and some things we're trying to do that we have on the train, on the track for some really impressive and really great things for the people that work here in this community. And the reality is that I'm exhausting myself. The fire chief's exhausting himself to make this plan happen. But we have this discussion all the time. Like we're probably not going to be able to reap the benefits of those efforts, but it's not about that. It's really about those that come after us. And
that's right.
And that's what you're talking about is like,
yeah,
I 100% agree with you. 10, 20 years down the road, you know, if I'm still alive and I'm still engaged and still paying attention, I can't wait to see what these really intelligent people can come up with to help us and how much we're going to laugh about the fact that, when I'm
talking. Can you remember when we sent men to do that? We had to make all these decisions in our head.
Oh yeah. So, you know, I used to have a paper map and that was it. And a handheld radio that only worked some of the time. Like people were going, what, you know, what do you, it's like when you have that discussion, you know, with your grandpa about cell phones, but that's
right.
That's what's going to happen. I guarantee it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, you know, you've positioned yourself to be the shoulders upon which the next generation of tech and tactics stand.
Let's hope so. I can tell you that, you know, people ask me a lot of times, like, you know, why do you do what you do? Or why do you write about what you write about? Or why do you do, you know, why do you have all these podcasts and all these things and social media presence? And I just tell them, you know, when you see the effects of what we've been through, and when you see the effects of not only or feel the effects of not only how they affect you, how they affect your family, how they affect your community, you see the devastation and the loss and the tragedy. If you're in this job and that doesn't motivate you and change you to put an effort in to make it better, you probably don't deserve to be in this job and you probably shouldn't be. So, and especially true if you're, you know, a leader in your organization or someone that has the ability to make the change or advocate for the change. So, it's like, there's no way I could sleep at night not knowing that I'm trying to do something to make this problem better, even if it's a one click on the dial.
Yeah, that's right. And I know, you know, people in this profession, you know, have to have ability to compartmentalize, right? Mm-hmm. Work now, cry later, right? From the things we see. But I tell you, you could bring me to tears in any given moment. You know, if you show me that picture of that 2-year-old girl in Australia at her father's funeral wearing his hat.
Yeah.
You know, that's what gets me up out of bed every day.
Yeah.
It keeps me awake at night. You know, that should just never happen. We should be doing everything we can to prevent that type of human tragedy.
That's why we're here.
And I know you know the picture I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's why we're here.
Yep, it is. Chad, it's been amazing chatting with you. And yeah. I think we have another 200 to 300 hours of conversation to have. So I hope we'll continue them, you know, over the upcoming months. And I really appreciate the enthusiasm and the vigor and the drive with which you go about this, realizing that it is a marathon, but taking the sprints when you can find them. So thank you for the work that you do, Chad. Really appreciate you.
Same to you. Thank you. Thank you for having me on and an opportunity to share some thoughts. I appreciate that. It's how we share this with all the others. And there's a lot of people out there that aren't on these podcasts and aren't writing that are doing great work. So
yep.
Shout out to them as well.
Big time. Thank you again, Chad.
Yep.
All right, folks. Well, you've been watching and hearing the thoughts, wisdoms, and entertainment of the amazing Chad Acosta. I hope you'll reach out and follow him, find his social media. I'm going to post links to where you can find his writing and his words, because it's truly inspirational, and a guy with his finger right on the pulse, and then he's not holding the pulse to himself. He's telling what's people what's going on, because he wants other people to be able to act on that information as well. So thank you again, Chad. And yes, thanks for joining us here on The Fire Break. I'm Steve Wolf. The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, dedicated to new techniques and technology to reduce wildfire firefighter deaths and property losses. Be well, and I'll see you at the next one. Take care.
See you, brother.